tags. One of the survivors enjoyed hurling filled urination bottles at Afghan children pleading for water on the roadside. To Cameron, it seemed capricious and cruel to suggest this event represented divine intent, that underlying all that carnage was some semblance of a moral order. God's will or God's plan. These phrases had seemed like stand-ins for I don't know. Verbal or mental disguises masking the possibility that nothing more than random chance dictated who died and who didn't. Or as one of his platoon mates put it, quoting from the movie No Country for Old Men, "The point is, there ain't no point." Extending this line of thought into his Biloxi backyard, Cameron found himself wondering, if it had been God's will, plan, for him to walk, then why had God paralyzed him in the first place? He knew what his old Sunday school teacher would answer, that his paralysis had been a test, like when God dispatched Abraham to kill his son Isaac atop Mount Moriah. But if it had been a test, wouldn't he have needed to pass it? Nothing Cameron had done since returning from Afghanistan seemed to qualify for a passing grade, unless he counted not killing himself. But all that should have earned him was a participation trophy. It seemed an awfully low bar for a miracle. These were thoughts Cameron kept to himself, however, as his visitors praised Jesus and asked him what it felt like to be on the receiving end of a miracle. A few pressed him for sensory details about the supernatural. Had he heard God's voice? Had he seen Jesus' face? At one point, the conversation shifted to a Todd Burpo and Lynn Vincent's best-selling book, Heaven is for Real, along with the movie adaptation that had been released that spring. Had Cameron read or seen it? No. Would he like to borrow the book? Yeah, sure. For Cameron, contradicting this level of certainty with doubt felt like a futile exercise, if not an insulting one. Nor did he feel capable of articulating his own vague and more secular reckoning of what type of miracle he'd experienced. The million-to-one play that his body had somehow cooked up. The 9 laterals his nerve endings must have thrown to pull off the somatic victory. Because here came his fourth-grade teacher, Mrs. Lacey, having rushed to Reconfort Avenue after seeing Cameron's photo on her daughter's Facebook page, launching herself into his arms, sobbing, thank you, Jesus, until Tanya had to pry her off so that an unsteady Cameron could sit back down. Moments like these felt immune to nuance. Not until the Sun Herald's Jesse Castaneda put the question to him directly, however, did Cameron realize how much this crowd-sourced interpretation of his recovery had affected him, had in some ways overwhelmed him. "Do you think God performed a miracle yesterday?" asked the reporter. Until then, the questions had been about factual matters, what happened and when. And in Castaneda's recording of the interview, one hears Cameron responding with a crisp and obliging efficiency, addressing Castaneda as "Sir," and chronicling the previous day's events with military concision. Then arrives a very long pause after the question about God. 23 seconds of silence before Castaneda gently repeats the question. Months later, after training with a media consultant and learning that you needn't answer questions directly, answer the question you want to be asked, not the one you're actually asked, Cameron would come to see how easily he could have evaded it, could have bent the question to his answer rather than the other way around. But this dynamic, and the cynicism underlying it, was still alien to him. Castaneda was asking him a yes or no question, thereby compelling him to answer yes or no, even if his honest answer lay somewhere in between. 23 seconds. To reject the divine nature of his recovery by responding with even a qualified no was out of the question. Denying God's active hand, he felt, would betray all the well-wishers who'd been streaming in and out of his house that day, some of whom were present during the interview, discernible in the background of the audio, as well as the hundreds of people who were still at that very moment hosannaing his photo on Facebook and channeling their prayers to and through him. Doing so would also betray Mrs. Dooley and the jubilant faith she'd shown as she'd come singing her way across the parking lot. And in some convoluted way, he thought, it would also betray his own dead mother, whom he'd never known to skip Mass on Sunday, and who, for all he knew, might have engineered his recovery from up in heaven, bequeathing her reward for a faithful life to her doubt-ridden son on earth. To give voice to those doubts in that moment, to answer with some variation of, I don't know, struck him as equally wrong, or maybe, for the weakness it evinced, even worse. Because though his doubts were real, they were still just doubts, clouds drifting low and heavy through his mind. It took Castaneda repeating the question to pull an answer from Cameron. Yes, sir, he finally said. I do. I think God decided he had another plan for me. This last line, he later admitted, was an inversion of something an army chaplain had said to him at the hospital at Landstuhl a few days after his injury. God decided he had another plan in mind for you, he'd said, holding Cameron's limp hand in his. At the time, he'd registered the chaplain's line in much the same insensible way he was registering the intravenous fluids entering his arm, and he was surprised, 4 years later, by the ease with which he retrieved it. He saw Castaneda smiling as the reporter lowered his head to jot this into his notepad. If Tanya's Facebook post, which required personal knowledge of Cameron's former condition to appreciate, or in the case of the later far-flung commenters, a measure of blind trust, displayed some virality, Castaneda's Sun-Herald feature all but exploded. The story, which ran under the headline, Paraplegic Biloxi Vet Experiences Miraculous Recovery, God Decided He Had Another Plan for Me, was neither long, about 18 column inches in newspaper speak, nor probing. Castaneda quoted the pastor at Biloxi's largest Catholic church, who said it sure sounded like a miracle to him, as well as an orthopedic surgeon in Gulfport, who said it was impossible to issue an armchair diagnosis, but that he was unaware of any other spontaneous, post-traumatic recovery of function like the one described to him. Familiar with its strict policies against public comment on specific medical cases, Castaneda didn't attempt to contact the VA hospital. But the story's nimble atmospherics, and the quiet, low-slung heroism that underlit Castaneda's portrayal of Cameron, cast a captivating glow. By August 28th, 2 days after its publication in the Sun-Herald's print and online editions, hit counters on the online version had already registered more than 3 million page views. If you exclude our Katrina-related coverage, it's been the most viewed story in the history of the paper's website, says Castaneda. It sort of boggles the mind. By week's end, the story had been picked up not only by religious websites, such as BeliefNet, Godvine, and the Christian Post, but also by more mainstream outlets such as the Drudge Report, Huffington Post, and BuzzFeed, where for a while on BuzzFeed's OMG feed, a rewritten version sat lodged between 14 places you'd never believe were in Scotland and 7 glorious photos of Idris Elba's bulge. Precisely what accounts for online virality, the particular triggers that propel people to share content, be it a news story or LOL cat video, remains a knotted mystery that content producers, marketers, and social scientists are working feverishly to untie. But Castaneda has a few hypotheses about why Cameron's story broke through. It was an incredibly positive story, for one thing, he says. People crave uplift. And it was an emotional story, an emotional mystery, really. Just think about the core elements. You've got a paralyzed veteran, this very solid and relatable young man, who somehow regains his ability to walk. If you're religiously orientated, it's a confirmation of your faith that you might feel driven to share. If you're a non-believer, it's kind of an out-there mystery that makes you curious. I think it just pressed a lot of different buttons. One button left unmentioned by Castaneda is timing. Saturated with unrelentingly grim headlines, the summer of 2014 was proving an anxious and depressing muddle, as the New Yorker's George Packer characterized it. An outbreak of the Ebola virus in West Africa was threatening to become a pandemic. Israel and Hamas were engaged in a bloody tit-for-tat in Gaza. An airliner was blown out of the sky over eastern Ukraine. The bodies of its victims left strewn across wheat fields for days on end. The manically endearing actor and comedian Robin Williams hanged himself in his bedroom. An unarmed black teenager was shot and killed by police in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, sparking violent unrest. And with the swift and sudden rise of the militant Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, the Middle East looked to be sinking into new depths of political instability. The night before Cameron's recovery, in fact, NBC's Tonight Show included a skit in which actual news anchors read fanciful stories they wished were true, rather than the genuine ones that, as host Jimmy Fallon said, kept tilting from bad to worse. Cameron's tale must have struck some people like a glint of hope amid all that gloom and gun smoke. Its suggestion for those open to it was that the impossible might be possible, that our understanding of the world and its workings, which seemed so darkly shadowed that summer, could still be dwarfed and illuminated by the world's enigmas. Judging by the thousands of comments left on websites and forums that week, even some skeptics found themselves wanting to believe. Cameron himself was one of these. Despite what he'd told Castaneda, a conviction he repeated a few days later for a local television reporter, he remained privately agnostic. This discrepancy in itself didn't bother him. He'd long been adept at cordoning off his private self, at negotiating the border clashes between his inner and outer states, a skill that his army service had only bolstered. What did bother him, however, was the agnosticism itself, the limbo of not knowing. A party broke out at the house that second night, with a half-dozen of Tanya's girlfriends pouring steady refills of blender margaritas, and Cameron discovered, a bit to his surprise, that with inebriation came clarity, that with tequila came faith. "Every time I'd get up to pee, when I'd get a minute alone," he recalls, "I could feel myself getting more and more certain about it being a miracle. I could almost see it happening in the mirror." He even got around to praying that night, after fleeing the living room some time after 1 a.m., when one of Tanya's girlfriends asked, more curiously than lasciviously, if everything below the waist had been restored. Tanya threw a hairbrush at her. Cameron hadn't prayed since his mother's death, not for any dramatic reasons related to it, but rather because she wasn't there to hound him about it anymore. Kneeling beside his bed the same way he'd done as a child, with the room spinning like an unlit carousel, and with the cackling of Tanya and friends bleeding through the walls, he thanked God for the healing. "I don't remember exactly what I said, and I'd probably be too embarrassed to repeat it if I did," he says. "It was pretty over the top." And then, despite the elated certainty that had been building in his bloodstream for hours, he found himself asking God for a sign, for some kind of signal that would confirm God's role in his recovery. But even as he was asking it, he says, he was imagining God's affronted rebuttal. "Healing you wasn't sign enough?" He woke up on the floor late the next morning, stricken both by a hangover and the resumption of doubts. He treated both, he admits, by opening a can of Bud Light. When Dr. Janice Lorimar Cuevas called him the following afternoon, then, her voice was a welcome one. He'd regained a significant amount of muscle stamina by then, enough to navigate his way around the house without crutches, though not without clinging to walls or furniture for support. While his legs were strengthening, however, he felt that his mind was weakening, faltering under the weight of agnosticism. Dosing himself with beer and company was lightening that load. He describes the 72 hours following his recovery as a rolling party, similar to the way they celebrate the days leading up to Mardi Gras. But he recognized the clarity this yielded him as ephemeral and artificial. Distraction therapy, to crib a term from his VA social worker, for his incomprehension. Yet that weight wasn't one from which he could free himself. His media interviews, he felt, were proof of that. Someone else had to lift that weight from him. "I guess I can be there as soon as you want me," he told Dr. Lorimar Cuevas. Because if anyone could do it, he figured, she could. Except she didn't. At least, not in the way he was expecting. His entrance into Building 30 of the Gulf Coast Veterans Healthcare System, on crutches, with Tanya at his side, provided Cameron his first taste of celebrity. Double takes of recognition, unusually effusive greetings from passing staffers, elbowings, gapes, a low hiss of whispers trailing in his wake. When he took a seat in the waiting area, as Tanya checked him in for his appointment, an elderly man sitting across from him fastened him with a hard and concentrated stare. He said, "You're the one from the newspaper." The man appeared bloated all over, as though inflated, and some sort of rosy, flaky skin condition claimed much of his big hairless scalp. A cane rested against his chair. "Yes, sir," Cameron answered. The man nodded, and then with significant effort removed his wallet from his back pocket. Tremors shook his hands as he fished out a card and offered it to Cameron. Both men strained forward for the exchange. The card, identifying him as a plumbing contractor, was yellowed and ancient-looking. The absence of an area code in front of the phone number suggested it was older than Cameron.
"That's my business card. I was in the Navy back during the Second World War."
"Lynn Falk," Cameron read aloud.
"I know a couple Falks," the man announced. "I got cancer."
Cameron swallowed.
"Real sorry to hear that, sir." "I seen you in the newspaper. I'd be grateful you taking the time to say a prayer for me about the cancer."
"Yes, sir," Cameron said. "I'll do that, I sure will, but..." He paused, portioning out his words with care.
"I don't reckon my prayers will work any better than yours." "Sure look that way," the man said,
just as Tanya walked up to say they were ready for Cameron to go back.
"All ready?"
Cameron said, accustomed to the trademark long waits of the VA system. And glancing up, he saw Dr. Laura Marcuevas herself waiting in the doorway.
"You take good care of yourself, Mr. Falk," Cameron said after rising. "You gonna say that prayer, right?"
"He will, mister," said Tanya,
ushering her brother forward with a hand fixed lightly to his back. Cameron had never experienced a medical visit quite like this one, with the doctor herself rather than a nurse administering the preliminary checkups, height and weight, blood pressure, the standard routine. Far stranger to him, though, was the way his mobility went more or less unacknowledged. The doctor said very little, in fact, beyond what was necessary to guide Cameron through the procedures. No one said much, not even Tanya, and after a while the silence attained such a presence that when the doctor turned her back, Cameron screwed up his face at Tanya to note the weirdness of it, and Tanya mirrored his expression back at him with a bewildered shrug. Not until Janice was done hammering his knees to gauge his now normal reflexes did the mood finally shift.
"Jesus," she whispered,
wagging her head with pent-up astonishment. It wasn't the absence of clonus, the jerky contractions his legs formerly exhibited during reflex testing, that broke her composure. It was rather the nearness of his rewired legs to her, the proximal, final incontrovertibleness of them.
"Jesus, Jesus."
"Something else, ain't it?" Cameron said, grinning.
"Whole thing happened in like a minute," said Tanya. "I just gone in to get some milk."
Recovering herself, Janice had Cameron tell the entire story to her again, transcribing everything into a notepad and peppering him with random-seeming questions unlike any the reporters had asked him. What he'd eaten for breakfast and lunch that day, what medicines he'd taken and when, if he ever used illegal stimulants or steroids or other drugs.
"Please let your brother answer," she had to instruct Tanya. "Whether or not he'd applied sunscreen or anything else to his legs that day. If he'd recently received an electrical shock, whether or not he'd felt anything at all different in the hours, days, or weeks leading up to that Saturday afternoon." After a while, Cameron gathered that there was some aha detail she was hunting. Was there something about how many fried oysters he ate that could shed light on this? So when the battery of questions finally ended, without any sign of an epiphany from her, he asked, half playfully,
"So was it a miracle?"
"Ah, that," She grimaced. I don't believe in miracles personally, so my own answer would be no.
Then what did happen? Asked Tanya.
Ignoring Tanya, Janice told Cameron, We're going to be running you through several different tests today. MRI, EMG, some others. You're basically getting the whole alphabet. And then later this week, or tomorrow if you can swing it, I'd like to get you over to Kiesler for something called a DTI. That stands for diffusion tensor imaging. It's not something we can do here. And then we're going to talk about getting you back into physical therapy for monitoring.
Damn, said Cameron.
It's going to be a long day, I know, she said. But a heck of a lot happier than our usual consults, right?
Cameron nodded and smiled, and then straightening himself on the examination table, he asked,
So what happened to me, Doc?
Something I can't explain at the moment, she said.
This most fundamental of questions, the first one she'd expected Cameron to ask, and one she herself wanted answered, was one she hoped to somehow put off answering.
Definitely not until I get a look at the test results.
Janice saw a pall of disappointment darken Cameron's expression, and she heard it, too, in the long sigh he emitted.
Then can you maybe tell me what might have happened, because—
No, she said. I can't.
Tanya slapped her thighs and muttered something unintelligible.
You can't?
Cameron said. Shaking her head no, Janice watched the disappointment on Cameron's face blacken into frustration. A faint growl edged his voice as he asked,
So is there anything you can tell me about why I'm not sitting in my damn wheelchair right now? Or if I might be back in it tomorrow? Because you already said it wasn't a miracle, so—
Look, she said, setting aside her notepad and softening her tone in direct proportion to how much Cameron's had hardened. We're kind of in uncharted waters here, both of us. Wonderful waters, obviously, but uncharted. The way medicine usually works is that a patient comes in presenting symptoms, and the physician dials in a diagnosis from a range of possibilities. In your case, we're coming at it from the reverse angle, which we definitely like. She smiled at him, drawing a gentle nod in response, but also without that range of possibilities.
So you got no idea, Tanya said.
Here's everything I know, Janice told Cameron. The imaging from prior testing suggests, and that's all it does, suggests, that something we call neuroregeneration might have occurred. That's when nerves repair themselves. They do that all the time in the peripheral nervous system. That's these outer nerves. She motioned to Cameron's arms and legs, connecting your limbs.
But not my spine.
Right. That's the central nervous system. And that's where the neuroregeneration doesn't happen. See, when the CNS is damaged, something called a glial scar develops. And by producing different families of molecules, the glial cells inhibit nerves from regenerating. The nerves are the same as in the PNS, but their environment is different. Basically, nerves can't regrow over a glial scar. Now, we can't say until we analyze today's tests, but there's some indication that yours might have done just that.
I don't get it, said Tanya.
Neither did Cameron, but he liked it. That molecules were involved was part of the appeal. Their role in his recovery, which, as a consistent D-grade student in high school biology, he judged too intricate for him to probably ever comprehend, freed him from the effort he'd been expending trying to understand it from a spiritual angle. And it didn't escape his notice that this explanation harked back to his own original theory, that the wonder, the miracle, was in the design. It flattered him to think he'd been correct from the beginning, before everybody else, as he'd later say, started filling my glass with Jesus juice.
So today's tests will show what exactly? He asked, leaning forward as though ready to immediately start them.
If the regeneration we think we saw was actually that, and if, by progressing, that might have allowed you to regain functionality.
Awesome, Cameron said,
but noted with a prickle of confusion, the doctor shaking her head and scowling.
But how come no one ever told me this was possible? How come they—
Because it's not.
Not what?
Not possible. Maybe you missed what I said a second ago, Sorry, I know this is a huge head full. The glial scar environment prohibits axonal regrowth. Neural regeneration doesn't happen in the central nervous system.
So now you're telling me something impossible happened?
No. A fluster eroded her tone. Because if it were impossible, it couldn't have happened.
I am so fucking confused, said Tanya.
Doctor, Cameron said, pausing for a moment to calm his own flustered mind. This is the most wonderful freaking thing that ever happened to me. To anybody. I mean, it's like I got born again.
That evocation didn't strike him until after he'd said it.
I don't mean like that.
I mean physically. It's like someone hit the reset button.
I mean, hell, look at me.
He kicked his legs out, his heels banging the base of the exam table.
But you know what the hard part is? And I feel like shit for even saying this out loud here, walking past them other guys out there who'd kill to be in my shoes.
Literally in your shoes, added Tanya.
The only hard part, he continued, is not knowing what the fuck just happened to me.
Cameron, I totally get it, Janice said, though she hadn't anticipated this level of concern, what sounded like desperation crackling in his voice.
Their phone conversation had suggested a more blithely elated Cameron, leaving her with the sense that lack of concern might present a clinical challenge for her.
We know a lot about the body and how it works, but we don't know everything. There's a number of medical conditions we simply don't understand yet. We call these idiopathic conditions. And then there are conditions we sort of understand, but not really. Rabies, for instance. It's been around forever, but we still don't know why it's fatal. Whether it kills brain cells directly, or shuts down the brain with overstimulation. If I had a rabies patient here, I'd be in the terrible position of telling that patient that he's going to die, and I can't explain exactly how or why.
Cameron grunted. Sounds like you just told me to suck it up.
No, no, not at all. What I'm saying is that I wish I could explain what happened to you, but I can't. Not yet. But we're gonna test the hell out of you today, okay? Because I want to know the reason you're walking as much as you do. Maybe even more. Because whatever your body did, other bodies should be able to do the same thing. We're all the same model.
Parts is parts, he said.
Janice nodded. Something like that.
So until then, what? Said Cameron. I'm supposed to say it's a... What was that? An idiopathic condition?
Tanya snorted. Idiopathic. No, it's...
Why ain't it a miracle? Tanya broke in. That's what the newspaper called it. That's what it looked like to me. I was right there.
Cameron nodded at his sister, then turned back to Janice.
That's what a miracle is, right? Something impossible happening.
Janice took her time asking, Are you religious?
Not especially. Probably a lot more today than I was a week ago.
Is that something you want to believe? That it was a miracle?
I don't know that I want to believe anything.
Because it's not my place to advise you on what to believe or what not to believe, said Janice. That's for clergy. My job is to deal with what I can see.
But it could be a miracle, he pressed, if the stuff you said was impossible really happened.
I can't stop you from using that word, but it's not my word.
What's your word?
I don't have one, she sighed. Not yet. But since we're defining miracles here, I'll give you my own definition of one for what it's worth. I'd say it's an event that happens in advance of an explanation for it. Cameron digested this for a while, staring down at his knees.
So I'm like a UFO.
Janice let out a rare laugh.
I can get behind that, sure.
UWO,
Tanya said, and in reply to their puzzled glances explained,
Unidentified walking object.
I like that even better, said Janice. Let's get you over to radiology, okay? They've kind of cleared the decks for you today. In retrospect, Janice would say, this initial post-recovery consultation was a failure. She'd dismissed the possibility of a miracle without marshaling any evidence to counter it. The scant information she did divulge, moreover, contradicted her position.
By disclosing that the phenomenal nature of Cameron's recovery appeared to be mirrored at the cellular level, she'd inadvertently fortified any claims for a miracle. "Because what nature can't explain," she'd say later, "supernature can, and will, and did." As Cameron recycled her words through his mind, while lying motionless inside the white donut hole of an MRI scanner, and later as a technician pricked his back and legs with needle electrodes, he experienced a clarity similar to the clarity that the tequila provided him. Science was confirming his recovery as extraordinary, but was unable to explain it, not even with a guess. The doctor had images, but the images didn't make sense. That was because his body had accomplished what bodies cannot accomplish. What had happened to him in the Busy Bee parking lot wasn't, as he'd previously thought, a miracle on par with Biloxi High throwing all those laterals to score a million-to-one touchdown. It was on par, instead, with Biloxi turning the Gulfport defenders into stone statues. Here was the sign he'd requested, the proof for which he'd prayed. His doctor banging his knee with a rubber hammer while whispering Jesus' name. On the ride home, overcome with euphoria unlike anything he'd ever experienced, he pulled out the business card he'd been given in the waiting room. Tanya glanced over to see him rocking slightly in the passenger seat, pressing the card to his forehead with his eyes closed and lips trembling.
"What the hell you doing?" she said.
"Shut up, I'm praying."
"You're praying?"
"Just shut up for a minute."
"Ah, shit," she said.
Chapter 5. The first hint of what was to befall the Busy Bee arrived on foot, on the morning of August 28th, carrying a 7-foot-tall red inflatable crucifix on his shoulder. He was wearing a tunic-style white shirt, from which the sleeves had been cut, and a pair of faded floral print surf shorts. Flowing indiscriminately from his jaw was a beard that was white with scraggles of yellow blonde. His skin evoked a dried apricot or mango, ochre, leathery, gnarled, and here and there dusted with windblown sand. He smiled almost constantly, but just shy of happily. Lenu Quinn was alone in the store that morning. A car honk drew his attention outside to where the man was hauling his big red crucifix across Division Street, indifferent to the stuttering traffic. Quinn watched the man beeline his way across the parking lot to the front of the store, where he rested his crucifix against a window, wiped the sweat from his brow with a forearm, surveyed the empty lot with a look of keen satisfaction, and then sat down on the curb. When a customer pulled in, the man shouted some sort of welcome that Quinn couldn't quite make out. The man did the same with two additional customers, one of whom, a regular, said to Quinn at the register,
"Didn't take long for the loonies to show up, huh?"
Quinn has never had much patience for loonies, who rank near the top of a list of human annoyances that includes drunks, solicitors, teenagers in groups of more than three, coupon users, check writers, shirtless men, $100 bill breakers, fake ID presenters, customers who smoke at the register, correct change verifiers, bathroom users, spare change dumpers, beer drinkers who bust open six-packs to buy single cans, navigators of freshly mopped wet floors, and coffee drinkers who use two or more nested cups rather than a cardboard sleeve. But loonies, or crazies, as Quinn prefers, come equipped with the most complications. It's easy to evict a solicitor, or to hustle out a drunk. With crazies, a more delicate touch can be required. Quinn wasn't feeling delicate that morning. Hat was at the dentist with Little Kim, and because the Lays have no dental insurance, and possibly because they grant their daughter free rein to the store's soda inventory, Kim's dental appointments had been proving reliably calamitous to their checking account balance. Quinn had spent the last hour girding himself for the damages, calculating, as is his wont, several worst-case scenarios. Kim's last visit had caused them to miss a lease payment on their car. But while this was the most immediate stressor, others lurked close behind. The state tax authority was threatening collection action on a first-quarter sales tax miscalculation Quinn had made. One of the Busy Bee's vendors had revoked 90-day terms, downgrading them to COD status, and due to an outstanding balance, their propane supplier had padlocked the big blue cage of tanks outside. About a month before Cameron's recovery, in fact, Quinn had mostly stopped opening the mail. Even the certified letters he slipped unopened into stacks. Exiting the store, then, he was in zero mood for a loony. Quinn is a small man, even by Vietnamese standards, yet the coiled energy he projects adds at least 6 inches to his stature. He wears his worries and aggravations like a very tall hat. Even behind the counter, where a degree of inertia is expected, he exudes a harried and frenetic air, tending to customers while also surveying a bank of screens, his laptop, the security camera feeds, and a small video monitor on which an action movie is often playing, that one regular jokingly calls the NATO Command Center. For this customer and others, it can feel like buying a candy bar from an air traffic controller. The Cuban-style guayabera shirts Quinn favors should temper this effect, with their suggestion of bongo ease, but they don't, especially when Quinn overstuffs the many pockets with notes and cigarettes and vendor invoices and other workaday debris, as though ornamenting himself with stress. He seems mired in a constant state of besiegement. "What you want?" he snapped to the man outside. "Good morning to you, brother," came the reply. Again, Quinn snapped. "What you want?" "I have come to meet Christ our Savior." Quinn shook his head. "He not here." The way the man chuckled called to mind a cartoon Santa. "Ho, ho, ha." "But this is the place, is it not?" The man pointed up to the sign. "The Busy Bee?"
"This is my store. I own it."
"Ah, then you are a blessed man, brother." The man gestured to the pavement between his feet. "This is holy ground."
"You going to buy something?"
Again the man broadened his smile. "I have not walked all the way from Chinchula, Alabama, for nabs and a Coke, I can tell you that." Quinn didn't know where Chinchula, Alabama was, except that it was in Alabama, which meant the man was either lying about having walked or he was crazy, or both, an even likelier possibility.
"Customers only,"
Quinn told him. Now it was his turn to motion to a sign, this one on the door.
"You see? No loitering."
"Oh, I don't wish to loiter. My intention is to wait." Quinn waved his arms as if to disperse the foul odor of this response.
"That's the same thing."
"I see. Well then." Lifting his eyebrows and slowly turning his head, the man assessed the storefront area. "Maybe I can go around side then. How'd that be?"
"No."
"All right then. How about over yonder?"
"No."
"Brother," the man's smile was diminishing now, as he lifted himself up from the curb, the effort shuddering his knees. "I've walked 37 hours. We're talking about the Son of Man here." Quinn folded his arms, unimpressed. Shrugging, the man lowered his eyes. "Reckon I'll take to the sidewalk, then."
"Not there either."
"Oh, come on, brother. That's a public sidewalk."
"Then go there, fine."
Quinn turned toward the door, not quite pleased with this arrangement, but guided by an old Vietnamese proverb. "Argue with a smart man, and you'll never win. Argue with a stupid man, and you'll never stop." "Mind if I leave my cross here?" the man called after him.
"No way!"
The man sighed. "You're not a Christian, hoss, are you?" Quinn paused in the open doorway, his loony evicting instinct validated by the faint growl he'd caught in the man's tone.
"I'm a businessman," he said.
"All the riches of the world," said the man, extinguishing any menace with his broadest smile yet, "are to be found in Christ the Savior." The bell above the door sounded Quinn's response as he returned into the store. From behind the register, he watched the man haul his crucifix to the corner and lean it against the street lamp post. He watched the man sit down beneath it on the sidewalk, facing the parking lot. And then, quite against his will, Quinn watched him wait. Ignoring him should have been easy, but wasn't. The man's unbroken surveillance carried a radioactive charge that Quinn sensed through the glass and from 40 yards away, an atomic-level disturbance that left Quinn feeling more jumpy and irritated than usual. Even with his back turned, he registered the man's stare. Customers provided a trickle of distraction, but after each transaction, Quinn caught himself glancing out the window and grimacing from the way the man's eyes seemed to lock instantaneously with his. Something about the intensity of the man's waiting, too, felt infectious, so that after a while, Quinn felt that he was also waiting. For what, he didn't know. But when he noticed the man rising, he found himself gripped by a strange excitement, and craning his neck for a view of what caused the man to stand. When it became clear the man was merely stretching his legs, Quinn cursed himself aloud, and lest he go crazy himself, vowed to ignore him for good. If not for that trickle of customers, he might have accomplished this. Every third or fourth one made some remark about the man and his cross. One asked if the man was some sort of advertisement, to which Quinn responded by waving his arms in that same odor-dispersing way. Despite all the questions he'd fielded since news of Cameron's recovery broke, Quinn hadn't devoted much hard thought to what had happened to Cameron outside his store.
"Amazing," he sometimes said. "Crazy," he said at other times.
Hat considered it a bona fide act of God, but then she considered everything an act of God.
"If she goes to the Piggly Wiggly for chicken and finds chicken on sale," he says, "that was God."
Quinn's own loose assessment of what had happened chimed with Cameron's initial take, that it had been some kind of extraordinary biological event, a natural marvel, to be sure, but no more or less a marvel than the grapefruit-sized sulfide meteorite that came crashing through a friend's roof in the New Orleans neighborhood of Versailles. That it happened at the Busy Bee, he figured, was mere happenstance, as when convenience store owners in luckier states sold winning lotto tickets, though the analogy doesn't quite align, as Quinn points out, because store owners receive a cut of lotto winnings. All Quinn had received so far was a slew of questions, and now a visit from a guy with a blow-up cross. Hat, Little Kim, and a $443 receipt from the dentist entered the store just after noon. Quinn was goggling the receipt in open-mouthed shock. This was the worst-case scenario, plus $100, when Hat asked,
"What's going on with the guy outside?"
Absently, he said,
"What guy?" "The one with the big red crucifix."
"Ah, some crazy," he said. "Says he walked here all the way from Alabama."
"Alabama? Why?"
"To meet Mr. Jesus."
Quinn started calling Jesus Mr. Jesus years ago as a way of needling his wife about her faith, but the reference had long ago lost its sting and was now marital parlance.
"Because of the newspaper?"
"I guess. He wanted to loiter out front, but I said, 'No way, buddy. If he stays much longer, I'm calling the police.'"
"How long has he been there?"
8:30 or 9, maybe, right after you left."
Hat peered out the window at the man for a while. Then she went to the visi-cooler and fetched a bottle of water. As she made to open the front door, Quinn said,
"What are you doing?" "I'm bringing him some water. It's 97 degrees out there."
"I told you he's crazy."
"Crazy or not, he's got to be thirsty."
"Then he can buy himself some water. No way. He's in front of a store. Don't encourage him or—"
The bell above the door sounded her rebuttal. This kind of bickering can sometimes feel like the default dynamic for the Lays. As with most married couples, however, the true nature of their disputes is rarely related to the subject at hand. They argue about the leaves when it's the roots they're angry about. For Quinn and Hat, these roots are their opposite worldviews. Quinn tends to see the world as a minefield of doom, with life defined by its constant brushing against death. He is never positioned more than an inch away from catastrophe. Hat's outlook can be difficult to unbraid from her faith, but theological certainties aside, a strand of optimism runs through her. The secular branch of her perspective can sometimes feel gleaned from motivational posters.
"Obstacles," she's fond of saying, "are just opportunities in disguise."
Yet with this earnest radiance comes a kind of strength, an immunity against the panic and angst that infect her husband. They both credit this polarity to their age difference. Quinn is 46, while Hat is 33, with Quinn citing naivete as a symptom of Hat's relative youth. Yet residue from their disparate childhoods in Vietnam must surely play a role as well.
Both of them left Vietnam at around the same age. Quinn as a 7-year-old in 1975, and Hat in 1989 as an 8-year-old. And both are the children of military men who failed to make it out of Vietnam alive. The similarities, however, stopped there. Quinn barely knew his father, who was a South Vietnamese army colonel stationed in Nha Trang. But what he knew of him was magical. Quinn remains half convinced, for example, that his father could communicate with animals, especially the geckos that overran the walls of Quinn's grandmother's farm in Vung Tau, which would halt and then thoughtfully respond when his father spoke gecko to them. Kak ke! Kak ke! When Quinn would ask what the geckos were saying, his father would say, "They are asking about you. They think you are too small, too much like them, and that you should eat more." Though the family lived most of the year in Saigon, it's the farm in Vung Tau that Quinn recalls most vividly. The funky smell of the longans ripening in the orchard, the black clouds of bats swarming the orchard at dusk, the betel leaf and areca nut aroma of his grandmother's kisses, the slow pounding of the gong lulling him to sleep during Buddhist prayer sessions, the pride and responsibility he felt when dispatched to the chicken coop to fetch the morning eggs. As to the war up north, his father rarely spoke about it, but when he did, it was as a mild and temporary irritant, like a vexing business matter unworthy of discussion in the home. It would be over soon in any case, he promised. Southerners like him had been repelling invasions for generations, from the Chinese, Chams, Khmers, Japanese, and French. The communists, his weary pose suggested, would be no different. The fall of Saigon, therefore, came as a galactic shock, a breach of reality. Still, his father acted nonplussed. In the days preceding the South's surrender, he arranged for the family to escape the country via patrol boat from Vung Tau that bore them to a U.S. liner headed for Guam. He was obligated to attend the funeral of a general, he said, but his plan was to follow in a few days and reunite with them in Guam. Instead, he was captured and almost immediately executed. Quinn doesn't believe that his father lied to the family about the dangers he was facing, or that he understated them, nor does he think his father was under any illusions about those dangers. His father's plan was solid, Quinn says, but it failed. His intelligence and effort weren't enough. The world ate him anyway. Listening to Quinn recount the story of his life, one senses that Adam, interviewed years after his eviction from Eden, might employ a similarly nostalgia-crippled tone. The fall of man recast as the fall of Saigon. All the tropical fruit scents and gecko magic fall away as Quinn's autobiography sputters forward, the vibrant colors fading into a black and white tableau. Penniless and reliant on charity, the Lays, Quinn, his mother, and his younger sister, drifted around the United States before locating distant relatives in Biloxi, one of the congealing points in the post-war Vietnamese diaspora. Quinn was among the first wave of Vietnamese immigrants and suffered the hard lot of a pioneer. He struggled through adolescence, hounded by bullies and hamstrung by his difficulties mastering English, and dropped out of high school 2 months before he was set to graduate. 1 year later, because of students like him, the Biloxi School District instituted bilingual education. For the next 11 years, he worked as a crabber for his mother's second husband, fishing for blue crabs and selling them to restaurants and wholesalers. But that fell apart when his stepfather lost the boat to gambling debts. In the meantime, he met Hat, who was 17 at the time. On the night he proposed, she says, he noted their age difference with fretful gravity, and also warned her that his life expectancy might be abbreviated, though he couldn't say precisely why. "He asked me to marry him," she recalls, "and then spent 2 hours trying to talk me out of saying yes." She found this odd but endearing, as though his care for her well-being trumped his desire to marry her. More than a decade passed before Hat finally became pregnant, enough years for Quinn to abandon hope. So when little Kim entered the world with her underdeveloped lungs, and the doctors in the neonatal intensive care unit assigned her long odds for survival, it made a kind of grim sense to Quinn, relaying the click of an awful logic. He awaits calamity with an intensity rivaling that of the man outside awaiting Christ.
If Quinn is a man in exile, from a place as well as a time, his wife is an exhilarated escapee. For him, leaving Vietnam was a nightmare. For Hat, it was a glorious dream. This is where their age difference bears some meaningful weight. Hat was born in 1981, a bleak and scorched period in southern Vietnam. She has no memories of luscious Longan orchards or magical geckos, or even of her father, a former mid-level army officer who was sentenced to a re-education camp before she was born and subsequently died there. What she remembers, almost exclusively, is the frantic waiting in a Saigon slum, with her mother exhausting every means possible to get Hat and her two sisters out of the country. This included handing over $1,200 to a smuggler, a sum painstakingly scraped together over a 6-year period, who then vanished with the money. Funds eventually dribbled in from relatives in Biloxi, along with news that the relatives' church would sponsor the family's immigration to the United States if they could somehow get to Thailand or Hong Kong. They left in the middle of the night, crammed onto a wooden boat with more than 100 other refugees. Hat's mother fell into a near catatonic state, terrified of Thai pirates who were said to throw women and girls overboard after raping them. As Hat's older sisters tried consoling their mother, Hat found herself drawn beside an elderly nun, sitting against a gunwale and calmly praying the rosary. The nun seemed unafraid, her spindly fingers constantly traveling the rosary beads, and after a while, Hat fell asleep with her head in the old woman's lap, tranquilized by the murmured Hail Marys and the boat's seesaw creaking. This pattern continued for days and nights, Hat's mother and sisters cowering nearby, while Hat was nestled into a trance that she likens to that of a cat waiting out a thunderstorm beneath a house. One morning, with dawn just a coral sliver on the horizon, a tremendous commotion on board jolted her awake. They were just off the island of Kokra in the Gulf of Thailand, and a flotilla of boats was headed fast their way from land. Pirates, for sure. The panic that greeted the sight almost capsized their boat. Hat heard her mother wail and watched her collapse to the deck, retching. Hat let out a wail, too, but holding her close, the old nun hushed her, saying the Virgin would protect them. The boats arrived, surrounding theirs. Two passengers leapt shrieking into the water, choosing the threat of sharks over the threat of pirates. But these weren't pirates. They were local fishermen who'd come to offer aid. Hat lost track of the nun as she and the other refugees disembarked on the island, and never saw her again. But as a model for how to withstand fear and suffering, as a lodestar for courage and equanimity, Hat has never forgotten her. The story of the nun emerges, in fact, as a digression in Hat's account of Kim's weeks in the NICU, as a roundabout way of illustrating the divergent ways she and Quinn dealt with that trauma. Quinn, she says, resembled her mother on that boat, all cold sweat and tremors. He waited for his daughter to die while desperately hoping she wouldn't. Hat, in contrast, awaited Kim's recovery with no allowance for any other outcome. When she prayed, it was for the speed and ease of Kim's recovery, not for the recovery itself. She never granted God that decision because she felt certain he'd already made it. This same rigid certitude was what Quinn glimpsed in his wife as she walked out the door and across the parking lot to where the man with the inflatable crucifix was stationed. Quinn watched her give him the bottle of water and for several minutes stand talking with him. Alone with Kim in the store, he wagged his head and cursed. Black thoughts came slinking into his mind, that perhaps this man was a serial killer, and might now be inspired to dismember her, or that he was a local con artist who'd sniffed an opportunity to swindle a Christian do-gooder like Hat, or that Hat might return to the store saying the man was grateful, but also wanted some Doritos. Back inside the store, she announced, "He has liver cancer." "Oh," said Quinn. "He's dying. That's why he's here. He's hoping to be cured." "Oh," Quinn said again. "He walked here for 37 hours straight." "That's a long walk." He cracked a roll of quarters into the register. "He should have taken Greyhound." "He said you were very rude." "What did he want me to do? This isn't a hospital. We don't cure people." "I'm just telling you what he said.
Did you tell him we don't cure people?
I didn't tell him anything.
You just gave him a Dasani water.
I did, she said. It's 97 degrees out there, and he has liver cancer.
And hospitals have air conditioning and free water.
Do you want me to pay for the water?
Why doesn't he pay for it?
This argument mellowed, but didn't end, for several hours, until a van pulled into the parking lot. The van was extra long and gray, and bore the name of a Hattiesburg church on its sides. Out of the van came 7 or 8 people, two of them young and clean-cut, but the others old and plump and slow-footed. From behind the register, Quinn and Hat watched as the people took cell phone photos of the store and the parking lot, and then joined hands in a circle. One of them spoke while the others closed their eyes and bowed their heads.
"Don't you dare bring them any water,"
Quinn told Hat, who made sure her husband noted her sneer before disappearing into the back office. The church group's members, however, didn't want mere water. What they wanted instead were random portions of everything. Beef jerky, candy bars, potato chips, sunglasses, automotive air fresheners, 5-hour energy shop bottles, keychains, Tylenol, cans of Dintymore stew. With great but reverent excitement, they roamed the 3 aisles of the Busy Bee, loading their arms with a haphazard array of non-perishables, while Quinn regarded them with a bewildered squint. Lined up at the counter, they peppered him with questions about Cameron's recovery, often interrupting his answers.
"Amazing," he told them. "Crazy," he said, with more questions.
They asked him for the precise spot where Cameron had stood, and after Quinn pointed to it, several of them went outside and took turns standing there with their heads bowed again. Then one woman, white-haired and heavy-set, asked Quinn if there was anything for sale with the name of the store on it.
"With the name on it?"
"Yes, sir," she said. "Like a koozie or something?"
Quinn thought about this for a while.
"Maybe a business card?" she asked.
Quinn glanced around, but the only thing behind the counter were his stacks of mail.
"I have some mail I could sell you," he offered.
The woman brightened.
"Can I see?"
He fished out an unopened bill and laid it on the counter. She pursed her lips.
"Anything else?" she asked.
He replaced the bill with a glossy catalog from a convenience store wholesaler. On its cover was a photograph of a cream and sweetener dispensing machine, upon which was glued a large label bearing the Busy Bee's name and address.
"Oh,"
the woman said, reaching to touch it, but then withdrawing her hand.
"How much for that?"
Quinn lifted it for dramatic appraisal.
$1, he said.
"That's fine," the woman said,
plucking a bill from a small change purse. When the church group finally left the store, it was with 9 pieces of Busy Bee mail, including a certified letter, for which Quinn charged an extra 50 cents, and with Quinn trailing them out the door with a wide and winning smile. He posed for a group photo in front of the store, and then waved as the van backed out of the lot and turned onto Division Street. When Ollie came into work, 30 minutes later, he found Quinn on the phone, still smiling, and nodding as he tapped keys on his laptop, with the phone cradled against his shoulder. Noting Ollie's entrance, Quinn placed his hand over the phone's mouthpiece and told Ollie he needed him to do something. "That man outside, with the big red cross?"
"Go bring him a Coke," Quinn told him. "And some Doritos, too."
Then he added seriously,
"We have a lot of work to do, big guy."
Chapter 6. On the morning of September 2nd, 28 of the Gulf Coast Veterans Healthcare System's physicians and nurse practitioners filed into the Recreation Hall in Building 17 for the hospital's monthly Interdisciplinary Quality Improvement Conference, or IQIC. These IQICs, which gather clinicians together to discuss patient cases in much the way cases get dissected in teaching hospitals, were a recent initiative mandated by Washington, and the center's chief of staff and medical director, Dr. Larry Turnbull, made no secret of his antipathy toward them. "Any time a doctor spends talking to other doctors," went his thinking, "is time stolen from patients." He opened this morning's conference without any sort of greeting, which, despite his antipathy, was uncharacteristic of him. Dr. Turnbull's beloved Mississippi State Bulldogs football team had 3 days earlier shut out Southern Miss 49-0, and his audience was expecting at least 10 minutes of a gloating recap during which to catch up on paperwork.
"Well," he said instead, "let's just get to our business here."
Dr. Turnbull, who is 74, is a native of the area.